All right. At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify, and that's my message to me, to keep it simple. Requirements for chairing a meeting at Central, Orlando's Saturday night speakers meeting, or 1 year continuous sobriety. Have Central as your home group, and have attended a group conscience meeting. My name is Suzanne. I'm an alcoholic. And Central is my home group, and I'm actively involved in our group conscience. It's my growing playground. My sobriety date is 8/18 of 87, and it's just a reminder of what God can do with a drunk like me, who was helpless, hopeless, and had no thought of really ever thinking this thing was ever going to take place in my life. I hit the rooms at 23, and I literally hit the rooms. I was the one that showed up for a year prior to finally getting sober, and I would drink and go to meetings, and I would talk to you about how sobriety was working in my life, as I had a little bottle in my purse. So I wasn't ready, and I was not convinced, like the reading talked about, that I was dealing with a fatal malady of mind, body, and spirit. And I'm just grateful today that, you know, I have a solution and a place to come and to be with my people, as I like to call it. You know, this is my family. And this is where I learned to keep growing up and trying to do things differently. So thank you for being here tonight. I have the great honor of introducing our speaker. And, you know, if you get to do a speaker's meeting, it's a very selfish thing in the sense of we get to hear the people we really want to hear, and we get to pick the roster of folks. And it's been a real honor to just do this last couple weekends. I met George probably about a year ago, and he was showing up at the Tuesday night meeting, and he was always very quiet and demure, sitting on the side, and I'm very quiet and demure myself, if you know me. And I thought, God, he's just always so pulled together and just calm, and, you know, and I'm like, you know, banging through here to go chair a meeting or sit down, or, you know, just a little too high energy. And the thing I like about George is that when George speaks, I know where his message is coming from. You know, it's that core place inside of us, that one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. And his message always resonates with me. So without any further ado, George.
Wow. I'm George. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, George.
My sobriety date's January 23rd, 2009. I didn't say that the last time I spoke, right, Brian Little? I forgot. So this time I'm saying it. I am an alcoholic. When I think about what I want to convey up here, there's so much. But the main thing is I know there's some people who are new tonight, newish, and I hope I convey the hope of recovery to you, because I came in here very hopeless, and I have been transformed by sobriety. Tonight I have people in the room who are my coworkers and friends, some of my dearest friends in Florida outside the rooms, who have never seen me drunk. That's amazing to me. And it means a lot that I have people like that in my life. I'm sorry, I'm going to get on my feet in just a second. You know, I ended up in Florida kind of by accident. And the months leading up to me coming into AA were filled with every type of alcoholic devastation and desperation that you can think of. I was in the parking lot of my work, which is not that far away from here, one Saturday morning. I don't know why I had to go to work that day, but I was on the schedule. I think it was about 9 o'clock, probably headed into work, and I was sitting there trying to muster the energy to go inside. And Category 5 hangover, of course. And, you know, I had known for a long time, I was about 25 at this time, I'd known for a long time that my alcoholism was really serious. It was a secret that I kept for myself, tried to. That day, I knew inside of myself that my drinking and partying was going to kill me, or I was going to kill myself. I knew that with a certainty I couldn't explain. The way I describe it now was seeing a wave, like a tsunami wave that was coming towards me. I didn't know exactly when it was going to hit. I didn't know what it was going to look like, but I knew there was no stopping it. And I got to Central on a Friday night several months after that. So I have a lot of experience, strength, and hope, and I hope I convey it to you guys tonight. Recovery has changed my life. This is so different than my day job, by the way. This is very nerve-wracking. I do have a lot of experience, strength, and hope, and I hope I convey that to you guys tonight. I grew up in San Antonio, Texas. I describe my family, especially my grandparents, the same way every time because it's how they were described to me. Both sides of my family were good people. My grandfathers were both attorneys. Neither of my grandmothers worked. My parents had, from what I understand, from what I could see, really loving, pretty affluent upbringings in Texas. They both grew up in San Antonio. And my grandparents were just, when I say good people, I mean more than just successful. I mean, they were involved in their community. They were very well liked. And I know that when my parents met in law school, they were expecting to essentially recreate the life that they had grown up with, you know. And there was every reason to think they would. They were both really intelligent. They'd already been successful in their own respects. They were becoming lawyers. And they got married, and I'm sure it looked great from the outset to everyone. They got hit with something that nobody could have expected a couple of years into their marriage. And that was the birth of my older sister, Carrie. Carrie was born healthy, but by the time she was about a year old, was diagnosed with brain cancer. And my parents were told she would die. So my earliest memories in the house were Carrie being not there in the hospital, and that's where my parents always were. So Carrie lived in the hospital for years at a time, pretty much continuously. And to this day, I sometimes don't know if it's a blessing or a curse, but Carrie survived. Against every odd, Carrie survived. And when I was, at this point, a couple years old, maybe 3 or 4, Carrie was well enough to come home and live in our house. But the amount of care that she required was staggering. She can't speak. She has to be tube-fed. Can't take herself to the bathroom. Has to be bathed. Can't dress herself. It's a severe handicap. And so she lived at home with us, though. I mean, she has the level of disability that you would think would be in a hospital or something. But she lived at our house, and that was very important to my mom. And so I was second in the setup, and then I had a younger sister and a younger brother. The impact of a disabled child, if anybody else in this room has something like that in their family or their extended family, is huge. My parents couldn't have been prepared to deal with it, and they weren't. They didn't know what was coming. My mother, God bless her, really took the lead on it. My father wasn't able to. You know, I think it was too traumatic for him. I can't diagnose anyone, but he suffers from a lot of the same emotions that I have suffered from. I know that. And he has handled them in a similar way. So the dynamic in the house was Dad not really willing to take part in caring for this extremely disabled sister, and Mom simply being unable to handle it. And so what that left me as the number two and a boy was to pick up the slack. And that was a role that I didn't know. I never thought I had a choice about it, but it was the defining experience of my childhood, caring for this disabled girl. And you know, alcoholics and all people in recovery talk a lot about shame, And I developed shame very early on in my life. I can see now as an adult, why would I be ashamed of a medical condition? But Carrie was embarrassing to me as a kid, terribly embarrassing. She would have these seizures that would, remember being at the grocery store and she would come crashing to the floor, you know, shaking. And everybody else thought she was going to die right there in front of them. And to be a little kid, already kind of meek and a little afraid, and then have this going on next to you was a lot for me to handle. So that was the context. And my parents, God bless them, you know, they, like I say, they could never have expected this, but the toll it took on their marriage was serious. The fighting in my house, I think if you grow up in a house with fighting, you probably never forget it. And it was terrible. The screaming, the late nights, the fights that would, I remember trying to break them up. And a lot of times, unfortunately, they were alcohol-fueled fights. So the role that I grew into was this role where I kind of got, I was kind of a parent almost to Carrie. Dad wasn't really doing that, and Mom couldn't handle it. And so I was in this odd position, I felt, as a child of needing to deal with that. You know, my mom needed me, but my dad didn't like me doing these things. So being at home was like walking on eggshells. But I found one way to deal with it as a kid, which was the best I knew how was to do well in school. And I knew that my parents responded very well to seeing me do well in school. And I made that my mission. Really, I became a perfectionist from a very young age, you know. And I wanted to do well in school, but I wanted more. I mean, I wanted to be popular. I wanted to do well in sports. I wanted it all. And the praise that I got from being successful seemed to be a sort of a good medicine for my family. People were happy when I did well. And I knew I could calm the house when I was successful. And I'm fortunate to say I was, you know. That became my governing philosophy through middle school and into high school, was success at all costs. And in some ways it served me well. You know, I've heard in recovery the things that keep us alive as kids will kill us as adults. I don't recommend perfectionism, but it served me at the time. And so I got, you know, I won a full scholarship to this private high school in San Antonio, and things looked very good from the outside. I was winning praise, and people were my teachers were satisfied with me. I did have friends. But I, you know, the classic feeling of many alcoholics, the feeling like the insides were just being torn up, was a central part of my story. My first memories of alcohol, I mentioned that my parents, my father is an everyday drinker. He has not missed a day drinking in decades. At a certain point when we were young, my sister and I said something to our mom about how much my parents drank, and she cut back, and to this day has been a lot more moderate. My first experience with alcohol, though, was very innocent. I think probably the way a lot of normal drinkers begin. It was at a high school party. I think I was 16, and the reason I was able to drink was because I could drive myself there. And I liked alcohol from the beginning, but I hear some people say they knew they were an alcoholic from their first drink. I don't know that that's necessarily how I felt, but I do know one thing for sure. I never could have fun again without drinking. I'd go to a movie with you if we were going to sneak a bottle in. I'd go to the theme park with you if we were going to drink before. I could only have fun when we were drinking. One thing I want to mention, because it wasn't all bad. I had a tremendous oasis, which I think was God, at work in my life as a child, and my grandmother, my mom's mom, who was sort of the only living grandparent who was really around us a lot, and she meant the world to me. She would tell me, I think she, you know, she saw what was going on with Carrie. She knew I needed a regular mother, and that's what she was to me. She was incredibly important. She called. She told me I was her best friend, and this is a, you know, 85-year-old lady. But I said that she was my best friend, and I meant it. She was incredibly important to me. So, you know, the thing about being a perfectionist is you get some stuff on paper that can work for you. And in the beginning, it did. I got into a really good college, which was a double-edged sword, as a lot of things are for us. Because I went away to Princeton when I was 18, and I'll tell you, if I felt like I was walking on eggshells at home, this was a whole new level. I got to this school, and I have never in my life felt like such a country bumpkin. You know, I was a Texas kid suddenly around these kids who'd grown up in New York City. They'd gone to these fancy private boarding schools. They already knew how to make friends. They seemed to have it all down. And I hear a lot of people talking here about feeling like they missed the instruction book on life. And that's how it was for me. I got to this school, and I was in over my head from the beginning. And a lot of the reason why was because of my drinking. I had no tools. I had no tools at all to deal with those emotions and those feelings of just sinking, except to drink. And so I really identify my first or second year of college, I was 18 or 19, as when I began identifying myself as alcoholic. Not that I would have told anyone, but I hear, you know, certain things that, you know, the way I was drinking, I couldn't really avoid it. One sort of anecdote from that time that I really mark as the beginning of it. I was 19. I was a sophomore at Princeton. Terrible grades. Couldn't show up to class. Very scared. Trying to make friends, but you know, it was so prickly, people couldn't really get close. It was a weird cycle, but. I was an editor of the newspaper, and it was a Sunday night. Sundays have always been tough for me, in recovery, before recovery especially. And I had the weight of last night's party on me. I was hungover as anything. I was worried about what I'd done, you know, who I'd slept with, everything the night before. And you know, it was 8 o'clock at night. I'm still living in the night before and the shame and the remorse. And I remember being across campus, you know, a 10-15 minute walk from my dorm. And it occurred to me, I lived in my suite, for the record, if this is not alcoholic, was called the Zoo. It was a 10-man suite, and it was the party suite. And I had stolen the night before during our party a bottle of whiskey from our party that we'd kind of collectively bought. And I snuck it into my room. And it occurred to me when I was editing the newspaper on that Sunday night, 19 years old, that if I went back to my room and drank that whiskey by myself, all that I was feeling, all that shame, all that remorse, all that shit would just melt. And I'd feel okay. And I can tell you, from the moment I made the decision in that newspaper room to drink, I hadn't even taken the first drink yet, but after I decided to drink, it lifted. And I went back to my room, and I drank by myself. And sure enough, it worked. So I finished that expensive college I graduated. Not very successfully, and not with a whole lot of friends, but I did have a few people who could tell I was really struggling and who were really kind to me, and I'm grateful for them, and a lot of them are still my friends today. But, you know, I moved to New York City for grad school and my first job right afterwards, and the alcoholic that had gotten started in college had a whole new playground in New York, and it got a lot bigger and a lot worse, a lot quickly, if that makes any sense. I did grad school. I graduated from that, and I got my first job at this crappy little TV station in New York. And talk about an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. I thought I was going to be the next Matt Lauer, and also I thought I was the biggest piece of junk in the world. I couldn't seem to get it right, you know. But I made a lot of fair weather friends, as it talks about in the book. Very many fair weather friends, and a lot of friends I never saw in the daytime. I will mention this only once. It's a big part of my story, and it is drugs. My alcoholism, I am primarily an alcoholic, no question about it, but I also used drugs heavily when I was living in New York, and I would tell people, I would walk up to people who I was partying with and told them that cocaine changed my life. I don't know what that meant, but that's how I felt about it. Cocaine changed my life. So I won't mention that again, but no, be aware that that is was a significant element of my story. And, you know, I mentioned it in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting because I used that substance to make me a better alcoholic. I was so concerned about how people perceived me that when I was using that, it was my perception. I could drink like I needed to drink and behave. At least I could talk by the end of the night. My tongue still worked. So that was a good thing. The darkness of the drinking in New York City is sort of hard for me to convey. I did love living in the big city, but the isolation and the loneliness that I was feeling during those days was really growing. I drove almost every day for work. I had to drive myself in a company car more times than I remember. I know I was not qualified to be driving that car. And every day I would drive, there's this highway around the edge of Brooklyn called the Belt Parkway. And every day I would drive this highway to and from our little TV station there. And there was this one turn that every time I passed it, I would wonder, I would ask myself, what if I just kept going? You know, what if I floored it through the guardrail and right over that edge? Every time I drove past that, I wondered that. Twice a day. So that's what it was like for me. On a little bit now funnier note, I want to mention another big element of my story is when I was drinking, I reached a level of promiscuity that boggles the mind. Boggles the mind. I slept with everybody, and it did get me in trouble. I slept with homeless people. I slept with millionaires. I slept with, unfortunately, I slept with a lot of people who were in relationships with other people. I think I was so hollow at that time in my life that if you were taken by somebody else, that meant that I should have that. That you were something I would want. So I got mixed up with somebody, and you know, I got mixed up with of both genders. I should note, I got mixed up with people at one point with the wife of a couple I used to party with in my building, and my experience with alcoholism was that I found people who were like me. And even if that meant on the streets of New York, I swear I could pick them out of a crowd. And it was like magnets. And in the course of all of this, I got myself into a relationship with a guy who to this day, I can tell you, I wanted to be more than I ever wanted to date. He was successful, rich, traveled all over the world. Really in good shape, an athlete, and married. And the most important thing was he partied like I did. And I remember the first time we got together for beers, probably two beers in, I asked, do you party? And that's a question you don't really ask people unless you already know the answer. And I was right. And I was right. And that was unquestionably one of the most destructive relationships of my alcoholism, and was incredibly hard to get out of. More on that later. But that sick relationship was a huge, huge element. I found other alcoholics who were as sick as I was, and those were the people I surrounded myself with. God was at work, though, because somehow out of that morass, I got offered a job down here. I didn't want to go. I really didn't want to leave my people, places, and things at all, but I'm grateful that my career was important enough to me that I somehow pulled myself away. And I should say, I almost gave up my career to alcoholism. I truly thought of quitting this stuff so I could stay in New York and party. I got down here, and it was a geographical cure for about 4 months. My schedule was such that I couldn't do that much drinking. I remember calling my old buddies in New York and saying, you know, I'm not drinking so much. I remember kind of bragging on myself. You know, I took notice of it, that I wasn't drinking as much as I had been. But I also wasn't making friends, and life happened. You know, as it always happens, wherever you go, there you are. And that grandmother who was so important to me died. And that set off what was my bottom. And it was about 6 months long. I tore around this town drunk more than I care to admit. I endangered many lives driving drunk. Hanging out with people that I didn't need to be hanging out with, people that I didn't really even know, you know. I was also increasingly an alone drinker. I drank by myself a lot when I was living in New York, took a bottle of wine just to get me out of the apartment. But here was a lot sadder and a lot angrier. Anger at Dad, still, of course. Angry at my sick relationship, angry at myself. I was at an apartment not that far away from this clubhouse, by myself, drinking alone, throwing things at the wall, crying, sobbing, crazy person behavior. And my last weekend drunk was not any worse than many that had preceded it. My parents were in town, which I took as absolute license to drink as much as I wanted. And they were paying. They never said anything to me. It was an interesting dynamic. You know, I in the course of one of these nights, it was a 4-day bender, and in the course of one of the nights, I got locked out of my apartment, broke a window to get inside. I woke up the next morning with that holy shit, and tiptoeing across the broken glass in my bedroom, cut my foot. So I've got this bloody foot on this white carpet in my apartment there. And I'm glad it's funny, but it wasn't funny at the time. Anyway, I get in the shower, and my foot is bleeding, and I am just sobbing. And I am screaming. And I'm screaming, I'm such a fucking alcoholic. I'm such a fucking alcoholic. I'm such a fucking alcoholic. Screaming. I don't know what my neighbors thought, but they were used to windows being broken and the like, so I guess it was just par for the course at that point. I got into AA on a Friday night. I don't know how. All I can say is that I think I had finally had enough. That last weekend was not my worst weekend by any means, but I guess it was the weekend where I said, I know I can't do this anymore. And I came to an 8 o'clock meeting, and I sat right somewhere on that wall on a Friday night. I hadn't drank the week preceding, but it's like I didn't know there were meetings on weeknights or something. So I came in here on a Friday night, and I can tell you that first meeting I heard a guy share who never even really comes to Central. His name is Paul. I've seen him around sporadically since, but he said something about alcoholics having bad self-esteem. And I heard the one thing I needed to hear in that first meeting, because that was me. I hated myself. I absolutely hated myself. And he said that, and that was enough for me to think, if this is a place of people who come in here hating themselves, I know I fit in. So I did. I came back the next day, and people were telling me you should come to a meeting every single day in the beginning. And I can tell you, I was willing. There was one thing that I was in the beginning. I did not believe in a lot of this stuff. I was not, I don't know, I thought 26 was too young to get sober. I could not imagine the rest of my life without drinking, but I knew I didn't want to drink. What a weird dynamic, right? I couldn't imagine going through the rest of my life without drinking, but I didn't want to drink. So they told me that's how a lot of us feel, you know? That's a very common sentiment. So I did come to meetings every single day, just like I was told in the beginning. And a sponsor selected me, which was huge. I swear to you guys, at that time I did not have the... I could be, when I was out there drinking, who knows what the kind of stuff that I'd say, but you get me in here without anything in my system, trying to ask another person to help me, I was incapable of it. I had a sponsor come up to me and say, look me in the eye, he said, do you need a sponsor? I'm available for sponsorship. It was like I was asking somebody on a date. I was like, I got all flush. I was like, I don't know. Do you really want to sponsor me? You know? But I asked, and I started doing the steps. And I can tell you, I came in here with a job, no DUI, no arrest, a very little bit of money in my bank account. 26 years old, and I did the first step unquestioningly. I knew I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was absolutely unmanageable. I had the feeling, I can tell you where I was when I sat in my car in Winter Park and I wondered how people could possibly do life sober. I could not imagine getting through the day-to-day of life without alcohol in my body. I did a first step, I think 100%. And I kept moving. And a lot of people are scared by 2 and 3, the idea of a higher power. And I understand that. I was hurt by the church as a kid. I hated it. My family went to church every Sunday, even on vacation. I hated it. My parents were my Sunday school teachers. But I got here so broken, I absolutely could believe that I was beyond human aid. And for me, that was enough in the beginning, to believe that I was beyond human aid. I did my fourth and fifth step with that sponsor, and people talk about being absolutely transformed by their sharing their fourth step inventory with their sponsor. That was not my personal experience. I had so much shame and so much crap and so much embarrassment and was full of so many secrets. I really left that fifth step meeting with my sponsor, which it was the first time I had told a lot of this stuff to any other human being. And I just felt kind of dirty. That was my experience. I felt vulnerable, I guess is probably the truer word. I felt like... I just told stuff to somebody that I couldn't take it back, and what was I going to do? Kept going. Did 6 and 7, did my amends, and kept pushing through. And I'll tell you the ultimate thing about doing the steps for me. I didn't think at the time much about them at all, except that I was doing them because... that's what people did when they were in here. I knew I wanted to be in here. And my experience with the steps was they made me a part of this group. And in the beginning, that was huge to me. That was absolutely huge. My sponsor told me I could act my way into right thinking. I had spent years of drinking trying to outthink the drink. I would try to plan my life closely enough to where I wouldn't get as drunk as I always got. My AA was the first place I had been where my ears were open enough to hear this idea of move a muscle, change a thought. That if I did different things, if my actions were different, the insides would follow. I was tormented by my mind during all my life. I felt like I could never shut the thing off, except with the drink. I had always tried to solve that from in here. AA taught me to begin doing different things, and that would change me in the other direction. Acting my way into right thinking was one of the most important things I heard in early sobriety. I went through nights in early sobriety where I thought I was going to absolutely fucking jump out of my skin. I had Friday nights where it felt like my body knew it was a Friday. It was supposed to have alcohol in it. It was crazy. And you know, I'll tell you, you know how I said at the time I did step 4 and 5 and I didn't feel at the time transformed by it? I can tell you today, those have been the most important steps. And trying to live 4, 5, and 10 have transformed my life. Another thing that I heard in the meetings was this idea that we are as sick as our secrets. I was an absolute secret keeper. I was a lockbox of shame, a lockbox of how much I drank, a lockbox of who I was sleeping with, a lockbox of where I'd been, of what I had done, of who I was with. You weren't getting it out of me. Today I can tell you, incorporating this idea that I cannot afford to have secrets in my life has been transformative. And I can honestly say there is no secret that somebody knows every single thing about me. Not everybody knows everything, but somebody knows every single thing. Even the things that took me 20 minutes of sitting there crying before I could actually speak them. And that's been huge to me. I do not have anything anymore that I carry alone. And that's been a transformative idea. You know, I mentioned that that alcoholic relationship. I wish I could tell you that as soon as I kind of got in the middle of the program, that ended and I got out of it. It did not. That took me 2 years to get out of that alcoholic relationship. And I'm not a relationship counselor, but I can speak from experience, and I tell this to my sponsees and I tell it to other people. There's a reason they say romances and finances will take us out. I got to a point 2 years in sobriety where I was absolutely certain, alone in my apartment again by myself, positive that I was going to drink and use again if I didn't get out of this relationship. And I was powerless to do it. I had returned to that alcoholic relationship dozens of times after I had sworn off it. It felt just like every time I went back to it, it felt like a relapse. And I had enough sobriety under my belt to know what relapses were, to know what that stuff was about. Getting out of that was something that I had to do just like my drinking, a day at a time. One day at a time, getting sober out of a sick relationship. And it has been one of the most important things that I've done in sobriety. It has been the hardest thing I've done in sobriety. I had to surrender that. I had to admit my powerlessness over that in the same way that I admitted my powerlessness over alcohol. It was that deep for me. The other thing that's been critical to me, you know, I talked about being tormented by my own mind, and that was such a theme all my life. I could not shut it off. And I would tell people, I can't control what I think. You know, I can't control the thoughts that pop into my head. I hate them, but I can't stop them. And one thing that I have learned in recovery is, to some extent, I was right about that. I cannot control each individual thought that occurs in my head. What I have the responsibility to do in sobriety is to change the environment, change the soup up there so the little individual pieces of noodles and vegetables that pop up aren't quite as crazy. Seriously, think about it like a garden. I had to change the soil in there so the weeds don't have as much stuff to grow with, you know? I was having shitty thoughts because I had a shitty whole thing going on up there. And when I changed the whole thing a day at a time, the shitty thoughts still come, but they're fewer. The other thing that's been huge to me is remembering that my alcohol, bless you, that my alcoholism is still alive and well in me. I always say in meetings, like it's become one of my little sayings, that I haven't gotten so well that I forgot I was sick. I say that all the time. I've gotten a lot better in recovery, but I have not forgotten the feelings, the thoughts that kept getting me drunk. How crazy is it that someone who has had the experience with alcohol that I've had, that you guys have had, how can I be driving on 1792 and see two homeless guys who are clearly without a shirt on their back, clearly blasted out of their minds, and have a split second of envy? How crazy is that? I can envy somebody who's blasted out of his mind, also homeless, no money, nowhere to go, as I drive to my nice job in my car with an... That tells me alcoholism is alive and well in me. And that's serious. The thing that has helped me with that, as I begin to wrap up, is this idea of don't believe everything you think. I think as you get more sobriety under your belt, or I'll speak for myself, as I've gotten more sobriety under my belt, I have seen that the alcoholic thoughts still occur. The difference is that today I can see them for what they are. I can call a spade a spade. I don't have to believe they are true, which is what I always did when I was drinking, and it always took me back to drinking. I can have crazy thoughts, and I can say, all right, I do feel that right now, but I am much more able to separate myself from it and believe that it is my alcoholism still talking to me right now. So, I want to tell people who are new, you know, in the big book it talks about there's this whole image of us being on like a cruise liner that has capsized or something. It talks about holding on to recovery like a drowning man would hold on to a life raft in the middle of the sea. So anybody who's newer to me, I encourage you to take recovery that seriously. I'm not always successful at it, but I can tell you, I think I put this stuff right in the middle of my life. And I believe it's there because it has to be. I cannot take it like lightly. I know that I could forget again and drink again if I don't keep doing the stuff that I need to do to stay sober. A lot of times in sobriety we can be moving backwards without even feeling it, when we think we're just staying put, you know? So they say the price of freedom is eternal vigilance, and that's what is required for me in 3 years and 7 months of sobriety. I make 4 meetings at least a week, and I have sponsees, and I try and stay in the middle of it. So I hope that my story was full of so much desperation and despair. I hope that if there's anybody who's feeling that tonight, I can just tell you, you can be transformed also. And I'm grateful to speak. Thanks.